Let me speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. Over the summer, we've been following with some interruptions. The last 2 weeks, I've been speaking about Jesus' bread of life teaching, which we've been following from John's Gospel. And last week's sermon has particular reference to some of the text that we heard this morning. But around that, we have been following the unfolding of ancient Israel's political transition from devolved confederacy to centralized monarchy. And this is primarily a story of the contours and the vicissitudes of power. It's a saga to enthrall, from murderous ambition and dynastic power struggle to domestic violence, family dysfunction, pain, and personal tragedy galore. And what interests me about this story, this whole history recorded by a group of scribes known as the Deuteronomists, is its timeless relevance to the exercise of power and authority in any age, but in particular the contemporary age in which we live. And with the reading this morning, we draw to a close this long survey of the Deuteronomic history with Solomon's dedication of the temple. In our modern world, we also struggle with the tensions between centralized and devolved government, between federal and state, and more recently and increasingly between state and municipal government. Shakespeare's immemorial line, which was put into the mouth of Richard IV, "Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown," certainly is a mantra that must have kept David awake many of a night, as with increasing intensity he experienced the unfolding of Nathan's dire prophecy of a chain of violence that would never leave him nor his house in peace. And yet I'm left wondering, however, if this sentiment ever crossed Solomon's mind. Coming full circle, "uneasy is the head that wears the crown" is certainly a mantra that Joe Biden is no longer a stranger to. But back to Solomon. In the second chapter of the first book of the Kings, we read that David slept with his ancestors and was buried in the city of David, having reigned an astonishing 40 years, 7 years in Hebron, and then another 30 after his conquest of Jerusalem. Now, the weakness in authoritarian regimes lies in the unpredictability of succession. As the one strong leader begins to fail, in the absence of constitutional processes governing the strict line of succession, factionalism thrives. In David's last years, anxiety increased about who would succeed him, and those who had once been the king's fixers, his right-hand men, vied to influence the succession. The death of Absalom left his brother Adonijah next in line for the succession. But following some pretty murky machinations by Solomon's mother Bathsheba, David passes his throne to Solomon. And before his death, David advises Solomon on how to clear the field by killing the opposition's ringleaders. This not only clears Solomon's way to the throne, but it also settles some of his father's old scores, the hand of retribution from beyond the grave, as it were. Adonijah appears to accept being passed over, but then gives Solomon an unexpected excuse to move against him when he manipulates Bathsheba into petitioning Solomon to give him Abishag for his wife. Abishag, you will recall, was the young woman chosen to warm the old king's feet in his declining years. And for Adonijah to claim her as his wife was tantamount to asserting his rights to his father's inheritance. Now Solomon is angered by his mother allowing herself to become Adonijah's tool, and gripped with fratricidal rage, Solomon orders Adonijah struck down. And before moving swiftly against all the opposition leaders, Joab, once the commander of the army, seeks sanctuary by grasping the horns of the altar. But Solomon nevertheless has Joab struck down in the heart of the Holy of Holies. He then deposes Abiathar the high priest, replacing him with Zadok, a passionate supporter of Solomon, and the way is cleared for what happens next. The Deuteronomic attitude towards Solomon is somewhat mixed. Despite his blood-strewn path to the throne, they seem to want to give Solomon a pass. On the one hand, he is presented as the embodiment of humility, requesting not power and riches, but wisdom. And God throws in power and riches as part of the package, and then entrusts Solomon with the task of building a permanent resting place for the Lord in the Jerusalem temple. And we heard of the dedication of that temple this morning. Yet this is the same man who had a string of foreign wives, who on ascending to the throne hightails it off to Gibeon, where he sacrifices 1,000 burnt offerings to the deities of the high places. This is the man who adopts foreign ways and worships foreign gods. This is the man who taxed the people into ruin and indentured the male population in the task of temple construction. This is the great king, the great and wise king, who is promised long life, but only lives to the age of 60. The most explicit sign from the Deuteronomists of God's ill favor. And this is the great king who destroys his father's legacy, leaving the United Kingdom of David divided into north and south after his death because of his extravagant rule. Like his father before him, Solomon is indeed a complex character. Yet Solomon seems not to possess any of the genuine humility of his father, a willingness to acknowledge his sin before God. And the final judgment of the Deuteronomists on Solomon is mixed, and despite his popular image as the personification of wisdom in the subsequent tradition, it is on the balance of historical evidence an image completely undeserved. Based on the absence of hard archaeological evidence, some historians of this period doubt whether Solomon ever existed. Certainly, much modern opinion is that the great Davidic kingdom, as presented by the Deuteronomists, was anything but great. Scholars divide over the dating of the Deuteronomic history, seeing it as completed sometime during the reign of Josiah in the middle 5th century before the Common Era, others even later as a product of the monumental root and branch re-editing of the Hebrew scriptures during the 4th century Babylonian captivity. Yet, whenever compiled, the Deuteronomic history creates an imagined golden age against which to explain Israel's subsequent decline and seeming abandonment by God. And the value of the Deuteronomic history lies not in its historical accuracy or its veracity, but in its theme of timeless truth. That the nature of power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That human society, left to its own devices, rests on the principle that power is there to be abused. And the history of the United Kingdom of Israel echoes in the tensions of our own time. Our society is grinding under the weight of increasingly huge disparities of wealth, under the pressure of unrestrained, monopolistic, and corporate greed. Western democracies are increasingly retreating in the face of a resurgence of authoritarian nationalisms that exploit our uncertainty and fear in a time of rapid change. From Samuel through David to Solomon and beyond, we see God's glory encased in vessels of clay. Solomon is the proverbial everyman. He is you and he is me. Like him, we too are creatures of our time, shaped by our culture. The continuing church scandals only too painfully remind us that even our religious institutions, while pointing us to something greater beyond us, are all too corruptible and fallible in the nature of human institutional life. And like Solomon, we aspire to love God, but mostly we follow our own counsels. We long to give our full allegiance, making Christian faith the unifying story around which our lives take shape. Yet mostly we march to the drumbeat of lesser stories that promise much, but deliver even less. The extraordinary thing is how we nevertheless give allegiance again and again to stories that, if we did but remember last time, spelled disaster. History may not exactly repeat itself, but from Saigon to Kabul, South Vietnam to Afghanistan, it certainly has a remarkable rhyming quality. The legacy of the Deuteronomic history is that human beings live in a moral universe in which actions have consequences. And our sense of a moral universe flows from the covenant Yahweh made with Israel, and which has now been fulfilled in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. This remains the only story with a power to shape our lives and our times in the direction that we truly long for. Like David and Solomon, we too are earthen vessels made of clay, struggling to reflect the divine vision for creation. The earth dries and burns, the ice melts and the seas rise. The oceans fill with our waste, and rising temperatures fan hurricanes and typhoons, not only of unprecedented scale, but also frequency. New viruses jump species barriers, exposing the fragility and injustice of our societies. Our inability to put self-interest aside and collaborate in the pursuit of the common good, whether domestically or on the international stage, continues to obscure the reality from us that we are all in this together. And no one is safe until everyone is safe. Witnessing hour by hour, day by day, the dire events of the collapse of Afghanistan. As our politicians rush to get down and dirty in the mire of the blame game, can we not hear God calling us to be better than we currently are? and to do better than we have up to this point done. Like Solomon and his people, we sit on the cusp of divine judgment. For the moral universe is one in which consequences most certainly follow actions. Amen.